Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, grandmother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, and emotion worker. She uses all of these skills to address the subjects we all struggle with in this conversation with a reluctant therapist. Happy Tuesday, Elizabeth.
Happy Tuesday, Hank. How are you?
I'm doing okay. How about yourself?
Well, you know, it's interesting because we're going on week three now that I've come in and I am filled with this overwhelming sense of heaviness. That's the only way I can describe it. It just feels like, again, as I described last week and the week before, that we're all in this sea of wild surf and heavy, you know, big waves, and that every time we come up for air, we get smacked with something else. And now we're moving, you know, into the sea of Harvey Weinstein and sexual assault and hashtag Me Too. And so we hadn't caught our breath from the Las Vegas. We haven't caught our breath or even come to grips with what's happening in Northern California and Santa Rosa and the devastation there. I mean, just, it's hard to catch your breath. And so I come in again just feeling pretty heavy and, you know, wanting to make sure that we address what's going on in the world appropriately, and also find a way to kind of maintain our mental health and well-being, since that's my job, and to try to find some way to live with both things, that sense of despair for everything that's going on around us and some sense of hopefulness or sense of peace within ourselves so that we can get up every day and keep moving on.
What about the idea of desensitivity? I mean, we're struck with these horrific events almost on a daily basis now, and like, can you think back and think of, okay, the Vegas shooting, that was two shootings ago. And
yeah.
I barely remember that anymore. And it's just like, it's just too much.
Right.
So what is on your mind today?
Well, the desensitizing is a really good point, because our main coping mechanisms for most people when things get too overwhelming is to numb, to kind of shut down, to do whatever we can to quell that anxiety or that fear, that trauma. And so that's when we have to be really careful, because it's easy to turn to unhealthy coping mechanisms like drinking too much or sleeping too much or eating too much or risky behaviors as a way of coping. And unfortunately, the healthiest way is to talk to people about what you're feeling, to have conversations, to get enough sleep, to eat well, to kind of make the effort to care for yourself, which takes a lot more effort than just kind of going numb and letting life happen. So that's definitely on my mind. The other thing I was thinking is, I don't know why I don't have feminist in my introduction. You know, that is interesting to me that it's not in my introduction, because it's something that I feel so firmly committed to. And yet there's something about putting it out there in my introduction of myself that feels a little off-putting, maybe too aggressive, that people might be offended if it's right out there, that I can say I'm a grandmother and an eavesdropper, but if I say I'm a feminist, that people might be, you know, a shy away from me. So that's on my mind. I'm also thinking about Domestic Violence Awareness Month, which we're in October. I'm thinking about the magnitude of the hashtag MeToo movement and all of the women that I'm connected to through social media who are posting about their history of sexual assault and sexual harassment. I had a conversation on Dave Congleton's show last week about this very issue and told some stories about my own experiences, which felt I felt really vulnerable when I was finished with the show, which surprised me also. I'm thinking about the recently released movie Battle of the Sexes about Bobby Riggs and Billie Jean King, and everyone sees it kind of like this fun little historical quaint story about something that happened so long ago. And yet this story of misogynist, you know, Bobby Riggs going after Billie Jean King and thinking he was going to, you know, topple the whole budding feminist movement by shutting women down now seems really poignant. That it's actually current. I'm thinking about this documentary film, Equal Means Equal, that I watched this morning because I kept hearing it come up over and over again in different areas and realizing, oh, yes, we have unfinished business as feminists. And I'm thinking about my conversations I had over the last couple of years with Rian Eisler. Remember, I talked to her. She's the author of Chalice and the Blade, and she's the head of the partnership economy.org and Partnership Studies organization. And she was considered one of the top 20 most influential thinkers in the 20th century. And in my conversations with her talking about the dangers of unchecked patriarchy or dominator culture to women and children, the environment and education, the economy and our very survival, and how we're seeing all of these things she and I talked about kind of bubble to the surface. And I'm thinking about how overwhelming it all feels when we approach them from individual issues. But if we take a step or two back from all of these issues, you can see that there is a connection between them all. And in the center of it, in the center of all of it emanating from the middle, is the source of the inherent injustices and imbalances that are in our culture. There is an imbalance because we live in a culture that is divided by two factions. And, you know, we like to think it's two factions like the North versus the South or East versus West or, right, the right versus the left. But it's really not about those two things. It's about a culture that's about those who dominate and those who are dominated. That it's really about a power imbalance. And in this dominated culture, it's really men, those in power, because men are still mostly in power in every aspect of our society. Even though women have made strides, men are really in power. That men utilize fear and force and funding to maintain rigid understandings of power and superiority in this structure. And so I'm thinking about the idea that until we dismantle these systems that support our culture of domination and find some way to replace it with a model of partnership, which Rhianne Eisler talks about, based on actually true equality for all, then we will continue to be dealing with the traumatic effects of every system that's currently in place that operates from a place of entrenched violence against women. So I guess ultimately we shouldn't probably be surprised about Harvey Weinstein or Bill O'Reilly or Roger Ailes or Bill Cosby, you know, or Donald Trump, because this kind of sexual assault and sexual harassment is so common for women. It happens on a daily basis. That really isn't the thing that should surprise us. I'm thinking that I guess what should really surprise us is that there is an almost willful ignorance that has taken over our culture over the last three decades, this kind of willful ignorance in believing that the feminist movement actually is over, that all the work was done, that we achieved equality in some way, and that nothing has stood in the way of women's advancements, especially since Title IX. This is a misguided belief, and this misguided belief that actually women are equal has driven kind of these entrenched inequalities deeper and made them more insidious because we fail to recognize them because we keep believing that it doesn't exist. And so in our refusal to kind of see them anymore and address them anymore, they've become more dangerous. So I guess that's, if you asked, what's on my mind today. And so in the wake of more bad news and this heaviness that I'm feeling today, I want to talk about the things we can actually do to bring about change, what that unfinished business is that we haven't addressed, that we really need to go back to truly advance the lives of those who are still oppressed on a daily basis. Or at least if we can acknowledge that that's a fairy tale, that with the passage of Title IX and the Equal Rights Amendment being offered up, and the idea that we are all now able to achieve all opportunities in life, if we can just acknowledge that that is a fairy tale and that we haven't gone in to live happily ever after, then I guess I'll be okay. So I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist, and you'll be invited to be a part of the conversation today. Our number is 805-781-3875. You can also find me on our Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist. Like the page, and you can keep up with our shows or leave us a message or start a conversation. You can send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com, and you can listen to previous shows at kcbx.org or subscribe to our podcast through Apple Podcasts. Just search for A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist, hit subscribe, and those shows will come to you, and you can listen at your convenience. So, Hank, let's kick things off today and listen to a little bit from the documentary we're going to talk about today, Equal Means Equal.
Time ran out for the Equal Rights Amendment today. The 24-word statement pledging equality for women fell 3 states short of ratification.
Women and men still do not have equal rights.
There's no guarantee against discrimination.
If you can pay a woman less than a man, then that's a huge savings to a company.
We're not talking about a glass ceiling here. We're talking about a brick wall.
Mothers are much less likely to be recommended for management positions.
The laws that I thought were going to protect me didn't.
Women are the means of reproduction. If we didn't have wombs, we would be fine.
We thought that the birth control issue was settled. It is far from settled.
Because our reproductive destiny is our economic destiny. It will affect our health outcomes and our economic outcomes for us and our children for the rest of our lives.
How can it be our country has more homeless women and children than any other industrialized nation?
Unless they are economically autonomous, all other aspects of empowerment will be defeated.
He pulled a gun out and he held it to my throat and he told me that I was going to die that day.
The police do not respond sometimes to violence against women in the same way that they respond to other crimes.
And we're being arrested at greater rates than we used to be arrested for.
We have something like 35% of all the female prisoners in the world.
A 13-year-old child was arrested for prostitution.
Rape is the most common violent crime on American college campuses today.
Victims are afraid to come forward. Perpetrators know that they can get away with it.
I don't know what it's going to take for people. Those are our girls. This is our country. These are our daughters.
This is why it's very important for us to be aware of who our lawmakers are and how much they're prioritizing women.
And I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and you're listening to A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. And that was a trailer from the documentary Equal Means Equal. And it's interesting, you know how something comes up in your conscience, and then you start hearing it over and over again, and then you think, I need to follow up on this? So a few months ago, I was invited to a meeting with my friend Laura Grace, and she introduced this documentary, Equal Means Equal, talking about the status of women currently and how we have found ourselves in this place of operating in this entrenched bias against women in all different areas of culture. And it was fascinating. I thought, oh, I really need to watch that. And I probably, I purchased it or added it to my queue probably 3 or 4 or 5 different times and didn't get to it. And then I was invited to the Women's Legacy Fund luncheon last month, and the keynote speaker of that luncheon was the director, writer, star of this documentary, Kamala Lopez, and she talked about her film, and I thought, I need to watch this film. Clearly, there is something important in here that I need to watch, because I think I kept pushing it off because I thought, I know this story. I know what's undone in the feminist movement. I know all the ways that women, are still struggling in culture. I know that there is a systemic war on women's advancement. I know all this. So I'll get to it. And then this last night, as I was thinking about the show, I thought, I need to watch that film. So I got up at 5 o'clock this morning and watched the film, and I'm turned upside down thinking about all that I did not know about the feminist movement and the unfinished business in our culture. And something that I thought I knew but I didn't really get was the fact that the ERA, the Equal Rights Amendment, that was approved overwhelmingly in 1972, had full support of both House and Congress at the time. Nixon supported it. It was quickly ratified by 35 states. It needed 38 to pass. Never was ratified. We don't have an Equal Rights Amendment. We have nothing that actually fully protects women's rights under the law in place at this time. We have lots of different attempts at protecting women. We have different statutes in place to protect women, but we don't actually have any amendment to the Constitution that fully supports and protects women. And that is inherent in all of the ways that women are not protected under the law. That even though we have laws against discrimination for pregnancy or wage discrimination or protection for women from sexual assault and harassment, though we have Title IX in place, the small percentage of court cases that ever are heard is minuscule compared to the amount of abuses that are taking place. And the times that cases are actually won and women's rights are upheld is even smaller. And so I'm sad I'd waited so long to see the film. I'm disappointed in myself, but timing is everything. And it seemed to fall into this time to see this film. And I absolutely encourage you to rent it and watch it. It's easy to get to and to start having conversations. And when we talk about, you know, the issues facing women and children and families at this time, it's overwhelming. You know, even the most staunch activists, I think, have a sense of battle fatigue, trying to keep up with all the different areas that women are losing ground rather than gaining ground. Most recently is the battle over birth control coverage in our healthcare plans. You know, that's not accidental. That's not just economic. It's not just about, you know, the rights of corporations who are seen as individuals getting to make a religious choice. It's about power and control. It's about stripping women from their inherent ability to participate fully in culture. And after decades of using abortion rights as kind of the cornerstone of the battle, it just kind of got a little more insidious, and we go straight to the conversation about access to reproductive health care. In the last 10 years, there have been 720 bills proposed aimed at reducing women's access to reproductive health care. And there have been zero bills proposed addressing anything to do with men's health care. And what's hard about this conversation is I don't want it to become a man versus woman, that men are bad and women are good, and that everyone needs to be esteemed, because that's how we get into trouble. Then everyone who feels like it's an attack on men shuts down and doesn't want to participate or feels that it's too aggressive. So I want to look at it less of a gender issue, men versus women, and it be a people issue or a systems issue. You know, that we look at a culture that's been completely defined by this dichotomy of those who dominate and those who are dominated, from kings to and serfs to masters and slaves, to the wealthy and the poor, to those with access to education and resources and healthcare, to those who are left behind. It's about this huge gap between those who have power and those who do not, and how those who have power wield that power and that fear and that funding to keep people, women primarily, in their place, whatever that place is. So I'm not sure where to go from here, because I want to open up the phone lines. I want to hear what you have to say, because I threw out a lot of thoughts, things that are on my mind. And as I said, I know everyone's feeling heavy and has a lot of thoughts about what's happening right now, and a lot of emotional energy is coming up. So I do want to open the phone lines, and I want to hear from you when wherever you want to go with this. But I also want to kind of flesh out a little bit more where my mind went besides watching the film this morning. I also, you know, was thinking about my conversations with Rianne Eisler. I've played the interviews over the air, I think last year, the year before. I can't remember now. Time goes so fast. But my talks with Rianne have really stuck out with me, because she introduced this idea of the dominator culture through her seminal piece, Chalice and the Blade, back in the 1980s, you know, forever ago, before some of you were even born. But this work kind of opened up doors for a new way of looking at the relationship between women and culture and their place in culture, and how we set up and define our relationships to each other and to the world. And So I went back and listened to my conversations with Rhian and kind of pulled out a section that has her talking about what she means by the dominator culture. So we can all kind of be on the same page with that. And her kind of foundational belief that we really will not see any change. We will not see any fundamental change at all until we address the economy, the economic piece of what keeps women repressed, oppressed, in a huge wage gap with men, until we address and follow the dollars that maintain all the decisions that are made in our culture, maintaining the economic wealth of those who are in power. And so she has developed and proposed this model called the caring economy, which works to uplift the status of those who are the caregivers in culture, which primarily 2/3 of the care work is done by women, taking care of children, taking care of the elderly, taking care of the sick, teaching our children. Those jobs and large numbers primarily fall to women, and their work largely goes unpaid, which results in a high rate of women 65 and older living in poverty because they spend a good deal of their life doing caregiving work without compensation and then don't have an economic resource. And she talks about how, because we don't esteem the work of caregiving or educating our children, and women are the primary workers in those areas, they live in higher rates of poverty than anyone else in culture because these jobs are not esteemed and therefore not compensated at the same rate as other jobs that we deem more valuable in culture. And so her proposal, which she has taken to the UN and spoken to Congress about and has laid out entire manuals of how this switch to a caring economy would not only benefit women and children, but would actually benefit the entire country and also the world, has really shifted a lot of the way I look at feminism in my work and how I feel like we can move forward to make real change. Because in some ways, addressing domestic violence and sexual assault in one area and then talking about foster care system and how we deal with family rights in another area, and then talking about the rates of female incarceration in another area, and then wage discrimination in another area. Like those are all fires we're trying to put out. And if we could get to the heart of this and talk about the economy and how changes in our economy and changes in how we view our partnerships with each other would fundamentally change how we move forward, that gives me hope. So I want to play for you a little bit of my conversation with Rhian Eisler.
Right, because you said that even if we have a partnership economy or a partnership, it doesn't mean there are not hierarchies still.
Absolutely.
So explain that.
Well, we need families. We need parents, for goodness sakes. We need teachers. We need managers. We need leaders. But the question again is, how is that exercised? How is that power defined? Mm-hmm. You know, the title of The Chalice and the Blade, really, The Chalice and the Blade are metaphors, aren't they, for two very different kinds of power. The blade is the power to dominate, to destroy, to take life. And that's a symbol of a domination system. The chalice is the power to give life, to nurture life. Both men and women have that power. Mm-hmm. And to illuminate life, there's always that spiritual dimension, that dimension of care, of caring for the world, for ourselves. What gives meaning, really, to us? The things we care about.
And it seems, because there's so much talk about, you know, climate change and the need to protect the environment and our resources in order to sustain life on the planet. And in some ways, it seems as if we had to shut off part of that innate caring that lives in all of us in order to live in a world where you saw destruction happening all around you. Like, it seems in some ways we've had to shut off parts of our natural empathy. Otherwise, it would be too overwhelming to live within a world of destruction and war and violence and poverty.
socialization for domination system gives you denial. Gives you denial about the pain that those, usually your parents or your teachers, cause you in such a system, you know, where violence is built into the pedagogy of learning, is built into parenting. It also gives you the power of denial about what's happening to our planet. But again, this work is about connecting the dots in different ways. And I can't emphasize this enough. You talk about the environment. The issue is not just industrialization. It's industrialization and overpopulation. And overpopulation is directly related to the denial of women in domination systems of two things: access to family planning. You know, men want to have the women as really technologies of reproduction, of breeding sons. Mm-hmm. And secondly, access to alternatives other than having children, to another role, okay? So in those areas of the world where you see this movement, you have lower populations in the poorest and, yes, still most domination-oriented areas. Africa, I'm sorry, I mean, this is where the status of women is so low in the Middle East. Violent, you know, honor killings, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, well, it's the same idea that control is what defines masculinity, be it control over the women in your household or the children in your household, or controlling another religion or another nation. Latin America with its macho ethic, it's all interconnected. And this is why we have to stop thinking of these so-called women's issues and, you know, gender definitions as something, yeah, we'll get to it someday, but they're not the main thing. You know, the main thing is the environment. Well, the environment will... I spoke at the United Nations on a panel on harmony with nature, and I made the point you can't just tack on harmony with nature to a fundamentally imbalanced system. It won't work. We have to connect the dots differently and see how all of these things are interconnected and where are the interventions. Childhood relations, gender relations, economics, really redefining economics. Capitalism and socialism came out of early industrial times. On that count alone, they'd be antiquated, but they also came out of much more domination-oriented times.
Right, because it's not just domination of men over women, but it's those with the wealth over those without wealth.
Well,
it's access to wealth.
We did a study at the Center for Partnership Studies back in 1995, which has since then been verified by studies by the World Economic Forum's Global Gender Gap Reports. The status of women is a powerful predictor of both general quality of life and economic success. And one of the main reasons, well, I mean, one reason is women are half the population, okay? Mm-hmm. But another reason is because of the dynamics I've been describing, that in those nations where, for example, women have the lowest status, you see these small elites, very small elites. And that's why we really have to pay attention to somebody like Trump, who's really all about, you know, well, women, you know, they're just, you know, sex objects, or they're just, you know, he is a poster child for domination system leadership, isn't he? And people are following him.
If you're just tuning in, I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. And that's a piece from my conversation with Rian Eisler from last year. And if you're interested in listening to that show and another conversation I had with her, you can look back to our kcbx.org archives, and maybe at some point, Bree can remind me when they were, and I can let you know at some point during the show. But she had a lot to say about, you know, the direction we're going and how we can't just address things from the symptomatic surface. We have to get to the source of what's going on, and that source of what's going on is a power imbalance between dominating and being dominated. So I'm curious to know your thoughts on this. What came up in the last half hour that we've been talking about the state of the world and the status of women? 805-781-3875 is a number to be part of the conversation. Catherine, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
Hi. It's hard to even begin to narrow down this issue because I feel like, one, it spans so much for women in different ways, but just my personal experience, I'm about to get married and I'm keeping my name, but it's definitely a point of contention with my fiance. Mm-hmm. And I'm older, I'm 31, and I have just had it through my life and my career. And I just don't see the point of changing my name at this point in my life. And I don't necessarily want him to change his name either, but it's really, I think sometimes he feels like that's the social norm. And it's so weird to me now at this point in this day and age that women still take their husband's name. And if you look at gay and lesbian couples, for the most part, there is no issue with that because they just each keep their own name or maybe make one up together. Mm-hmm. And it's just so interesting with a male wanting the woman to take his name and kind of lose her identity in a way. So that was just kind of my comment with the theme that you're talking about today.
Well, I'm curious to know, did your fiance tell you why he felt concerned that she didn't want to take his name?
So when we've talked about it, he's used the term, well, it's the social norm. Mm-hmm. And also, he's even said that it is slightly embarrassing to him that I don't take his name, which is interesting to me because he really is very supportive of my choices of women being able to get the pay they deserve, and other things. But it's like this issue is so, it's interesting to me because he is so kind of old-fashioned about it when he's not in anything else mm-hmm. in his outlook on women.
Well, and one of the things I find interesting for a lot of young men today or men today is, again, this: there is a shift. Men are more open to equality and wanting to have more partnership because it's healthier for them. You know, the toxicity
right.
of our masculinity and our culture has given men higher rates of heart disease and they die earlier and high levels of stress. So this shift to more partnership is in their best interest. And we see that everywhere. But what doesn't shift is a little bit of the societal embarrassment, right? That there's this idea, if your wife doesn't take your name, then you're less of a man. That masculine
right.
standard still is pervasive, and that your fiance may be fully on board, but it's hard to stand up against kind of a cultural pushback, like, are you not the man of the family? And even though he's not feeling those things, that's a hard thing to stand up to.
Yeah. And he, another one of his reasons was he didn't want to, if we had kids, which we're not even sure about at this point, but if we did, he didn't want them to have hyphenated names just for ease of lifetime, I guess for the rest of their lives to have a hyphenated name, to make it less complicated, which I also find mildly irritating just because it's like he doesn't, I feel like it's an ownership thing to me sometimes. And he would never admit to that, and I don't know that it really is. It just, that's how I feel mm-hmm. that it to me, it comes off that way.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think there's also that piece of, for men, they aren't giving birth. They don't have that innate, right, bond with the child. And I think there is a piece of that sense of wanting to be connected, that the name connects them. Because I don't believe that everyone, you know, that every man feels like they owned their child or own their spouse. But I think there is that desire to feel connected, to feel that we're family, and that name, I guess, always represents it. So I understand the conflictual nature in it, and I don't have an answer. I know that from, you know, the 80s on, we've had a lot of hyphenated names. That, and as you said, once you've hyphenated a name, and if you married someone with a hyphenated name and then you have children, they it starts to become complex. And then the other right. thing I think about is that currently 2/3 of the children born to women under the age of 30 are being born to women who are single. And so if we continue this practice of naming children patrilineally, we have a lot of children growing up in a home with different last names than their mothers if the father's mm-hmm. out of the picture. So it is not an easily resolved topic.
Right. Yeah. And so that was kind of just my comment on the whole, I mean, you're talking about things with concerning women that are much more mm-hmm. involved and much bigger issue than just names. But, just kind of a little slice of life from my perspective. And I also played sports in college, and it was just so much of our day-to-day lives are male-based. It's such a man's world, and so much that we...
Oh, Catherine just dropped out. I'm sorry you dropped out. If you get a chance, Catherine, call back in. And I wonder if she was going to talk about, although we have Title IX and that protection for women to access to education and athletics at every federally funded educational institution, we still see, again, huge power imbalances, that money still goes to support men's sports at a much greater level, that we still value the work by men in athletics at a much greater level. And the inequality in pay, we see what's happening with the women's soccer team right now, and they have a whole PSA movement going to raise awareness about, you know, equal pay for women playing soccer, who bring in larger crowds. And then goes back to the Battle of the Sexes and the movie with Billie Jean King and Bobby Riggs, the story of that if Billie Jean King hadn't won that match against Bobby Riggs, what that would have done to women's athletics and women in general in society, how far that would have set women back. And the pressure she had on her to win that match was incredible, because it became symbolic of the entire belief that men are inherently stronger than women and smarter than women and more powerful than women, then therefore should be in charge of women. So that's where we are today. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. You're listening to Public Radio KCBX. We're going to take a break and come back and take your phone calls. Continue the conversation at 805-781-3875. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist, and we're talking today about the role of women in society and the unfinished business of the feminist movement, and questioning myself as to why I don't have feminist in my introduction to myself. Why am I hiding? Why am I allowing that to be something that goes underground, as if that has been that is finished business, when it's clearly not finished business. and how are we going to move forward addressing wage discrimination, pregnancy discrimination, the levels of female poverty, domestic violence, international women's rights issues, rape and sexual assaults at epidemic levels in our culture, the rates of female incarceration, reproductive health care. How will we address all those things if we don't, as women, stand up and hold our ground? So, Catherine, let's finish up your thoughts because you got cut off.
And you kind of went into women in sports. You really kind of hit the nail on the head about unequal pay. I've previously worked in a Division I athletics department, and it's really, really amazing the amount of money. Sometimes it's called guarantee money. The men's teams will get for going to play a big name school. They'll get, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars to play this game, whereas the women playing that same big name school will get maybe $10,000 mm-hmm. or something that they use essentially to fund their program. And it's just incredible to me that people don't get it. If they don't, you either get it or you don't. And I don't really know how to bridge that gap. Not to bring up the current president, but I feel like I have friends and family that still support him, and they cannot see the common sense of the damage he's doing. They don't see it. And how do you even start to get somebody to see how wrong it is for women to be treated the way they are in other countries, in sports, in life, in relationships, if they can't even begin to grasp that reality?
It's why we have these conversations, Catherine, because I think what you're feeling is common for a lot of people. And we don't have an answer yet, because again, there's a lot of fear that drives people's behaviors. Fear that if I don't go along with the cultural norm or what's happening, that I will be socially ostracized, or I'll lose the little advantage that I do have. So fear is a powerful weapon. 805-781-3875 is the number to be part of the conversation. Henry, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
Well, this lady, Catherine, mm-hmm. I disagree with her in terms of taking her husband's name.
Okay.
Because in my view, a woman who won't take her husband's name is a woman who's not committed to the relationship.
But would it be equally fair to say then he would have the option to take her name if it's about the bonding of the relationship?
A man is certainly able to take a woman's name if he so chooses. I don't.
Okay. But I mean, would that free you, would that solve the issue of commitment to the relationship as long as a name is taken by both partners?
What solidifies the relationship for me mm-hmm. is if a woman takes my name. Mm-hmm. If she refuses to do that, then I believe she's not really committed to the relationship, and it's just one foot, one step out of the relationship. It's an exit point.
Mm-hmm. And I can appreciate that.
And I won't go along with that. I just won't.
And so is there a middle ground? You know, like hyphenating the names, or, you know, how can we create partnerships that are strong enough that the name, right, is more symbolic than actually symptomatic of the connection.
A hyphenated name gives the children a disadvantage, because they grow up in a society where, are you this person or are you that person? Yeah, it's not about ownership. It's they're part of a relationship too. They're the children of two parents.
Well, and I think it is.
They need to be raised committed to the relationship, the familial relationship as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, Henry, I appreciate you calling in and sharing your thoughts, because I know that that is a common feeling, that if we don't have a common name within the family, then how do we build that familial unit? How do we help people feel like they're committed to and part of something longstanding. And it's complex. It's not that simple. Again, if you look at the rate of divorce and remarriages, and if we're worried about children feeling a part of a system, feeling nurtured and held in a system, but the system breaks, there's a divorce, the parents never married, the mother has children with someone else, then you end up having a mother with children with multiple different last names, then we're still in that same predicament. A marriage is not a guarantee that the children are going to be raised in a unified system if that's the overall concern. And I don't know if it's that simple, but I also know it's something that we're grappling with. So where do we go from here? You know, in watching the movie Equal Means Equal, one of the things that stood out, another thing that kind of got to me and reminded me that I don't know as much as I had hoped I knew about the subject, was a comment made by Antonin Scalia when he was interviewed talking about women's rights and protections under the law and why women, you know, still struggled with wage discrimination and pregnancy discrimination and rape and sexual assault that goes unconvicted. And Scalia said in the interview, flat out, that women aren't protected under the law, that the Constitution, as it is written, does not clearly state that women have any federal protections under the law. And that even though society may have changed, culture may have changed, it is not written in the Constitution, which is the document by which all decisions and legal decisions are made in this country. And when I heard him say that, I went cold, because I realized if this is so, then as women, we are far less protected than we believe we were or are. That, again, when it comes to areas of discrimination or poverty or rape and sexual assault, although we have amendments and laws in place, they aren't carried out. The level of conviction rates for rapes on college campuses is less than 2%. And yet, we have the highest rate of sexual assaults on college campuses ever before in history. It continues to go up. And so, just on that front alone, having any law in place at all is meaningless if the Constitution doesn't support the laws, doesn't support or acknowledge the rights of women, and that we don't have a judicial system that's going to stand by women. We can't move forward. Again, it's the position of those who are in power who dominate those who are not in power who are dominated. And then if you spend a lifetime in a system, if you're raised in a system that continues to remind you that you are powerless, that you don't have rights, that men are more important, smarter, stronger, wiser, although we have pockets of change in our society, when you look at the overall population of this country and the world over, not just in this country, but the world over, we have not advanced as far as we think we have. Although we have women in Congress and women in places of power, the CEOs in the United States, only 5.2% of them are women. And there was research that was done talking about how can we tip change towards more balance. How can we bring equality between men and women? And the only way to do that is to get more equality into those bodies of government that pass laws, into Congress, into the Senate, into Parliament. And they said the magic number is 33%. When 33% of the seats are held by women, you can start to see systemic change or change within society. And we currently have less than 19% of the seats held by women. And so the ability to make a legislative change is farly diminished because there just aren't the women in places of power to make a difference. 805-781-3875. It's the number to be part of the conversation. I was going to say the competition, which is really interesting because it does feel like that we are in this competition for women to gain some sort of status. And it's interesting because if you look at, and Rian Eisler talked about this, that if you look at history for the last 100 years, coming on the 100th anniversary in a couple years of the 19th Amendment, women's right to vote. In those 100 years, for every steps forward that women have made, there have been dramatic pushes back. Pushes backward to keep women, you know, out of places of power, out of places of influence, unable to gain access to their rightful place in society, to, you know, not having access to birth control, to be able to manage their reproductive health. And one of the lines in the documentary was, reproductive destiny is directly related to economic destiny. That if women are unable to control the amount of children that they have, their ability to attain economic stability is greatly reduced. And, you know, not to be a conspiracist, but maybe this is a bit of conspiracist talk, is that if you are the men in power, if you're the patriarch in power, and you don't want to hand over power, because who would rightfully just say, we're done having power, go ahead, you take it. That's not going to happen. And you recognize that as women gain economic stability, they probably have less need to stay in relationships that are imbalanced, where they're doing 2/3 of the housework, 2/3 of the childcare, right? 2/3 of the caregiving work in all of society. When women start to have economic stability and they don't need to have that male power economic hand taking care of them, that they might not put up with all the other imbalances. And that starts to feel destabilizing to the status quo. And that's when we start to see change. And I go back to the ERA. It was only 3 states away from being ratified. And in March of 2017, just a few months ago, Nevada actually ratified the ERA amendment, making it only 2 states away. But the Equal Right Amendment ratification deadline passed in 1982. So it's basically symbolic. But if 2 more states were to ratify it, let's say Illinois and Virginia, then that would send a message that this amendment is of value and that the deadline needs to be reinstated, because there's no reason why that deadline was a deadline. It could come back. But unless we have some specific thing that we can fight for, because see, that's what's causing so much chaos, is there are so many fires to put out. We're not sure what one thing to fight for. The suffragist movement was about one thing to fight for, which was the right to vote. And so now to rally around this idea of reinstating the ERA deadline and getting it ratified and having it passed and put into law would then start the ball rolling for legal protections under every area of the law of the world that women are now not being protected. What do you think about that? 805-781-3875. Hi, Angela. Thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
Hi. Well, my gosh, so much. The issue of taking the man's name when you get married. I am recently divorced, and I did not take my husband's name. He didn't push me to do so, and I'm so, so grateful. When you take your husband's name, it's not just symbolic. It is official, and it changes on your Social Security card, and you have to go through changing your name with Social Security and with your employer and with your all of your life insurance, homeowners, and health insurance. It's not just a single thing in signing your name. And then undoing that takes a long time and many, many steps. And then forever, it's something you have to write down. You know, as an AKA, I was so-and-so, I am so-and-so now. So much so, it's so much trouble that my mother, even though she divorced my father, still has his name, and they've been divorced for 20 years. It just is, it's so much trouble. And I feel like there are so many other ways to show that you're committed and in this loving relationship. You know, you're sharing a household, you're sharing your finances, all of the, you're sharing, you know, all of your daily life, and you're making a promise to this person to be with them forever. And I feel like it's just an antiquated thing. A woman doesn't have all this time to spend changing her name with all of these entities. It might have been easy back when all the woman was doing was caring for children and taking care of the home. But now, when our names are on all of the paperwork, the mortgage isn't in our husband's name, the insurance isn't in our husband's names, we have our own vehicles, all that stuff, it completely changes all of that. It's antiquated to think that changing our names is reasonable or even a way of showing respect or love.
Well, and it's interesting because I'm surprised that this became kind of the overriding issue, but I think therein lies this idea of ownership and autonomy, and can we make equal loving partnerships without having to have the power play of a naming, right? The names that also identify you as being a part of their life. So, Angela, I appreciate you calling in to share your perspective on it. And it's clearly those things that seem small that continue to drive the systemic entrenched bias against women in culture, our policies against women and children in culture. It's a conversation that's much larger than the hour that we get to have every week. So I encourage you to watch this documentary, watch it with your daughters, watch it with your sons, please watch it with your sons, because ultimately this isn't a woman's issue. As Rianne Eisler said, this is a cultural issue. This is a man's issue as well, because the hostile environment for masculinity is not good for men's health either. That having domination as the cornerstone of how we get people to behave or follow suit in our society is not healthy for anyone. So equal means equal. Check out my conversation with Rianne Eisler back at kcbx.org through our archives. I have two different conversations I had with her, which I found illuminating and encouraged me to continue my own studies. And I encourage you to continue this conversation with your friends at home. This is not the last time we're going to talk about it. Please make sure you're doing things to care for your mental health and well-being during these heavy times. It is a stressful time to be trying to take care of our families and our homes and our work life and our friends and ourselves. So eat right, eat well, sleep well, take walks, take time to breathe, and take time to recognize that you are of value every day. And this has been a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. You can contact me at elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. Find us on our Facebook page and also subscribe, please, to our podcast at Apple Podcast. And as always, thank you for supporting Public Radio KCBX.
Everything's changed. Nothing remains the same. Everyone must change. No one and nothing remains the same. Young becomes the old. Oh, mysteries do unfold. Cause that's the way of time. Nothing and no one remains the same. Sunlight from the sky and hummingbirds do fly. Young becomes old.
trees do unfold. That's the way of time. Nothing nor one remains unchanged. From the clouds, sunlight from the sky, hummingbird.